Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, you might not know her by name, but if you despise government waste, mismanagement, and bad practices, you will appreciate our first guest. Elaine Howell has been California's state auditor for 21 years, and in that time, her department's audits have been pivotal in uprooting fraud, waste, and abuse of power with a fine-tooth comb. But we are approaching an end of an era. She'll be retiring at the end of this year, an announcement that received really an anomaly of bipartisan praise at a time when gridlock is just cemented in pretty much anything revolving around politics and government. California Auditor Elaine Howell joins us now with an impressive two-decade career acting as an independent government watchdog. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much, Vicky. Thank you for your kind words.
Well, I got to say, as a journalist in Sacramento, in my very, very short time covering the Capitol and all things surrounding government, I always looked forward to your state auditor report email releases. They were a lot of my pitches and a lot of stories that I did in my time in Sacramento. So it's just a pleasure to finally be able to speak with you, because usually you stay behind the audit and the findings.
That's right. Right.
Well, given the widespread praise since announcing your retirement, how has that felt? Was that surprising to you?
Yeah, somewhat surprising. I mean, this office has always had tremendous support from the legislature, both houses, certainly leadership in both parties. But it certainly was nice to hear some of the praise. And of course, I'm really proud of what this organization has accomplished during my tenure and before I became state auditor. I've been with the office 38 years, so it's been a great career.
Well, becoming a state auditor isn't necessarily something we're even aware of when kicking off our career. How did you land in this role?
Right. Actually, I wrote a story on leadership for a leadership book, and the title of my story was From Athlete to Auditor. What? You know, this is crazy. Certainly didn't, as a child, when somebody asked me what I wanted to be when I grow up, you certainly don't think of being an auditor. I landed on the job. I was actually a student at Cal State Sacramento. My brother was working in the Capitol, and I was new to California. I'd only been in California for a couple of years, so didn't know a lot about public service and California government. And he suggested, he said, you might want to apply for a job at the Auditor General. You're going to learn a lot about state government and then maybe decide to go work for a particular state agency. And I needed work. I was graduating from Cal State Sacramento in 82 and needed a job. So looked around for a variety of different state jobs. And fortunately, the Auditor General hired me at that time in 1983.
And in 38 years, 21 of which as heading the department, and really talking about an agency like taking the heat, I mean, that's not really for everyone, but you've been up to it, up to the task time and time again, even going back to your first big audit report involving Enron and the energy crisis back in 2001. How do you reflect on that responsibility?
Right. It's a huge responsibility. And one of the things that I really took seriously when I was appointed state auditor was, you know, reflecting on the people who mentored me as an auditor in the organization. I grew up in this organization. I started entry level, worked my way up, never thought for a million years that I would end up as the state auditor for California. But when the opportunity opened up, my predecessor went private sector, started his own firm. This is a one-time chance for me to take on this role and hopefully lead the organization as well as my predecessors did, and lead it even into greater heights than we had ever accomplished. And it had a sense of responsibility to the staff, but also to the people of the state of California and the mission of this office. It's incredibly important.
What did that experience teach you going back 20 years with that energy crisis and obviously feeling the responsibility, but now the pressure is on in terms of preparing yourself for potential pushback or fallout that can come from your audits?
Mm-hmm. Right. And you're absolutely right. The very first audits that we did, and that was, you know, trial by fire, conducting the audits during the energy crisis in California, where the state had to take over purchasing power. And there was pushback. There was a lot of criticism of the work that we had done. But I knew that we had followed standards. We had followed the protocols and practices that we had you know, used historically and knew that the work we put out was accurate and complete, and I needed to defend it. So I think actually having that kind of pressure right out the gate really prepared me for the next 20 years in serving the state.
The few times that we get to see you really is at the state capitol when you're testifying at committee hearings about your findings. That's a great deal of pressure because your subjects often aren't very happy with what you're going to say. Is there a particular time that was most challenging?
Well, certainly the energy crisis testimony there, there were a lot of oversight hearings related to that. And that taught me that I needed to be fully prepared because I knew going in there would be some members who were supportive of what we did and other members who were not. And certainly the individuals or entities that we audit oftentimes are not happy with the results. But we always know, and I always knew, that the work my staff had done had been through a really stringent quality control process. So I knew what was in that audit report was accurate. But I did. I needed to be prepared for criticism. And as I have said in some other interviews that I've done, the prep time that I put in to prepare for a 15-minute, 20-minute presentation is hours. And the reason I do that is I want to be the most prepared, the expert in the room on that particular audit report and be prepared for criticism and be able to respond to that.
Yeah, we don't even have to go back 20 years. We can go back during the pandemic. I mean, arguably the biggest audit during this time, and I covered it, was billions of dollars in unemployment fraud within EDD. I mean, I remember interviewing people across the state waiting for payments for months. I'm just curious, did the gravity of your findings surprise you?
They disappointed me because we had audited EDD back in 2010 and had identified their claims processing struggles, their struggles with their call center, and had made some suggestions not related to a pandemic. Nobody expected a pandemic, but, you know, we go through a recession every 5-6 years. So we knew there would be a cycle again. That was the recession back in 2009, 2010, when the legislature asked us to look at EDD then, when people were struggling to get through to the call center, struggling to get their claims processed. So we were disappointed to see that EDD really hadn't made much progress. And the pandemic certainly exacerbated the weaknesses that EDD has in its processes and its call center. So it wasn't necessarily surprising, very disappointing, but we felt a responsibility to the legislature and certainly their constituents, the people of the state, to try to come up with some resolutions, some recommendations that could be implemented immediately, and then some longer term solutions for the struggles that EDD has had.
And it's important to note when it comes to your audits, they ultimately have to be approved by the state legislature, and that doesn't always happen. Have there been opportunities missed, perhaps some that were introduced by lawmakers but ultimately didn't cross the finish line? I mean, the DMV comes to front of my mind.
That was the first one. That was what I was going to speak about, Vicki. Certainly, the legislature was interested in having us get into DMV and looking at the real ID under, I think, Governor Brown was the governor at that point in time. Now, he certainly sent in a strike team and had them do some analysis. But that was one where the legislature decided that the resources of our office wouldn't be used for that. EDD, same thing. I mean, Governor Newsom sent in a strike team that came up with some very strong recommendations. But the legislature in that particular situation decided, no, there is serious problems with EDD. So they went ahead, but it ended up being an emergency audit that really limits the amount of time we can spend on a job because the committee rules limit the cost of that audit. But what we decided to do, I said, we had already identified billions of dollars coming into California for COVID relief, not just unemployment, but education money, money for certain social services programs. We had identified that as a high risk issue. So that allowed us to spend more time at EDD and ultimately be able to produce two reports, one on their processes, call center and claims processing, and then the second report related to the amount of fraud and fraudulent payments that were paid out to people.
And the amount of work that goes into all of the research that you and your team do. I mean, as state auditor, there is a team behind each and every one of these audit reports, and you've been there for 38 years, starting entry level. Can you peel back the curtain and give us a sense of the type of collaboration that goes on in your department?
Oh, a tremendous collaboration. I mean, our audit teams, you're absolutely right. The way we view the team is, you know, the actual audit staff, the manager, the supervisor, and the staff are out doing the work, but we have an attorney assigned to every audit. I feel that myself and the rest of my executive management team are part of that audit team. I meet with the staff at least 4 or 5 times during the course of the audit where they're giving executive management updates. I read multiple versions of the audit report, starting with a status document, an outline document, and then multiple drafts. So we work very collaboratively throughout the audit process. If the team is out there running into access issues, people are reluctant to give us information, I instruct teams, you need to let me know, especially my attorneys, you need to let me know immediately because we need to address that issue. And we do run into access issues with a variety of different departments.
Before we let you go, what advice do you have for the person who's going to take your spot?
The advice I have is, I hope that you respect the independence, protect the independence of the office, the integrity of the work that we do, and certainly the mission. It's a wonderful job. It's been a great career. But the advice I have is you have to protect the independence and the integrity of this office. Otherwise, the credibility is gone and the work that we do doesn't have the relevance that it has now.
Elaine, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been an honor. Thank you very much.
Congratulations on just such a wonderful career that
Thanks
we all benefit
so
from.
Thank you so much.
And that is California Auditor Elaine Howell, who is retiring at the end of the year following an impressive 21 career acting as an independent government watchdog. Up next, the Sacramento City Unified Superintendent joins us about the district's vaccine deadline, which is today. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Today is the deadline for thousands of students 12 and older, as well as staff members in California's 10th largest school district, to show proof of vaccination against COVID-19. The Sacramento City Unified School District gave parents of students 12 and older and staff a little over a month to submit proof of vaccination or file an exemption to attend in-person learning. The decision by the school board received a flood of responses from parents both in favor and against the requirement. Many had questions about the validation process, testing, and some even questioned the need to require vaccines for children in this age group. So, what's the progress report for the district now the deadline has arrived? Sacramento City Unified Superintendent Jorge Aguilar joins us. He joined us actually on Insight back in October, and he joins us again today to provide us with an update on the district's progress. Superintendent Aguilar, welcome to Insight and thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity, Vicki.
So of the more than 43,000 students in your district, roughly 19,000, a little less than half, are eligible to get vaccinated. How many have submitted proof of being at least partially vaccinated?
Well, thank you again for the opportunity, Vicki. In fact, the 19,000 students that are eligible, and today is the deadline. Today is November 30th. So we'll be processing a lot of information this evening, well into the evening, and we'll have a report tomorrow, as well as a report to our board on December 16th at the regularly scheduled board meeting. But what I can tell you is that as of this morning, about 25.5% of our students have either demonstrated and uploaded information that they are fully vaccinated or that they have had the first dose of the COVID vaccine. Now, I do want to mention that this was somewhat exciting as we were analyzing some of the data. We were averaging about 400 submissions daily. Yesterday, we received well over 3,000 submissions, and we have about 3,600 submissions that are pending that are going through data quality, data integrity processing. So we expect to see another increase in the submissions by the end of close of business today. That number represents about 25% of those students that are eligible. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the data look like at the end of today. And certainly we will be reporting that information to you and others.
When it comes to those who don't submit that proof, what happens after today?
Well, what will happen after today is our team will begin the process of doing a lot of reaching out to our families. We want to make sure that our families have access to any information that might have created a barrier to submit at least, again, the first dose of proof of the vaccine. And that could be issues related to language, related to access to technology. We do want to make sure that our families also have a deep understanding of the ways in which they can provide some of that information. Those that may not have access to technology, for example, we do have a process by which families can visit our schools, drop off some of that information, get copies done, and then internally we will process that information as well. We know that certainly we have a lot of families that may have some of those access obstacles, and we want to do everything we can to make sure that they understand other ways in which they can provide that proof to the district.
And there's another deadline in January. How does that differ from this one today?
Well, the January deadline is going to be the deadline for full proof of full vaccination for our students and our families. And I do want to be clear that the November 30th deadline is to either submit full proof or at least proof of first dose of the COVID vaccine. We wanted to make sure that we gave ourselves a number of weeks, also knowing that we're about 3 weeks before the winter break as well. And so all of our staff will be working diligently, as you can imagine, during the break to make sure that that January 31st deadline is met, hopefully by all families, certainly so that all families understand the process that they can take to make sure that we have that proof for their students and as well as for our staff.
Where are we in terms of proof of vaccination for your staff?
For our staff, which is a great question, Vicki, we are currently at about 72% of staff that have uploaded and provided information that they are fully vaccinated. About 0.02% have filed a medical exemption, a little over 1% have filed a religious exemption, about 27% have not responded, which is about 400 of our staff. So we will take the same approach as we are taking with our students and our families. We will be making sure that all of our staff are fully aware of the process that's available to them to make sure that they can upload that information to us. We're also working with some of our labor partners to make sure that our staff members fully understand the importance of meeting this deadline as well.
For those who choose to be unvaccinated, does anything change between November 30th and January 31st? Like come Monday, they won't be able to go into the classroom?
No, not quite yet. What we will be doing, again, we gave ourselves this time, is we have started the process of making sure that there is regular testing schedules taking place at schools, but the effective deadline is still that January 31st one. We have continued to, for example, hire and train staff. We have health aides at each of our schools to administer that regular testing. We've started the process. We are actually going to be announcing the schedule of what that testing schedule is going to look like at each of our school sites. We really do think that as a matter of priority for the district, to make sure that we can continue to serve our students through in-person instruction, which is what they desperately need, that testing is going to help us detect community cases of COVID and take steps to mitigate the spread, which I just really want to commend all of our staff at Sac City. We made a commitment when we came back to in-person instruction in September that we would have very effective testing protocols. And I'm very proud that our team was able to stand up testing sites at each of our school sites, at the district office. Our students don't have to go to clinics, don't have to go to their medical provider. Certainly they have the option of doing it. But I think given the population of students and families that we serve, some of them who have a lot of transportation challenges, having access to these health care centers where students can access and get tested for COVID, I think has been very, very helpful to us.
On your dashboard, you not only do you have vaccination progress, you also have, you know, positive cases total, as well as active cases and quarantine. Where is the district at right now when it comes to positive COVID cases and students who are currently in quarantine?
Well, it's very interesting that you asked the question. On Zoom, of course, you're able to see that I'm in my office, and of the dashboards that I'm monitoring as superintendent daily, those are two of the four that I'm monitoring every single minute. One of them is the total number of cases, and we are at 839 with 7,700 students and staff that have been in quarantine. We have five active cases and 20 active quarantine cases. So it's very interesting that our role in public education, as you can imagine, has shifted significantly. These were not dashboards that existed, nor were they dashboards that we were tracking on a daily basis. And I think I can speak for all of my colleagues, superintendents across the region and state, that these are really important data points that we are tracking now every single day to make sure that we continue to serve our students and families.
A couple of weeks ago, someone placed leaflets on cars in Sacramento urging Sac City Unified parents to reconsider vaccinating their children. And I ask this because I'm just curious, how has the district handled the pushback that some of the pushback that it's received?
You know, I will report that of the 25.5% of students and families that have reported to our vaccination portal, we have about 0.36, so about a third of 1% who have filed for an exemption. And certainly we are very sensitive, Vicky, to the fact that these are very trying times, very difficult choices that families have to make. One of the questions that I'm getting often is what happens to those students that are 5 to 11 year olds right now, and what will be the timeline? And we will provide a report to the board on December 16th. We are convening a group of health experts. Again, this is not an area that we were trained to work in. So we are working with very close colleagues through a colleagueship of expertise, if you will, with health professionals and policymakers to make that decision and report it out to our community. But I mentioned that because I think it is critical that we continue to be sensitive to the fact that these are very anxious moments for many families. There are a lot of doubts, and we want to make sure that we give families the opportunity to access hopefully truthful information, information that is backed by the science, of course. And I think that we've done that through the information sharing that we have been able to provide through our website, through a town hall that we've also provided. We are here to and stand ready to answer any questions that our students and families have. The other thing that I would say is certainly we want to be so, and we are at this point, so respectful and sensitive of this, Vicky, that those students and families that make the choice not to go through a vaccination, of course, have the option to undergo regular routine testing. And we want to make sure that that is a process that's available to them. Eventually, I think we will continue to listen to those medical experts, hopefully continue to get guidance from the state, because COVID is still a material threat, and it will be a threat to us continuing to be able to serve our students through in-person instruction, which I think is what they desperately need at this time.
Back when the school board approved a vaccine mandate for children 12 and over, following that, the CDC and the FDA approved emergency use authorization for children age 5 to 11. Have there been talks among the school board? You just talked about an upcoming meeting coming up in December to potentially expand that age group to include 5 to 11 year olds.
That, in fact, is what the resolution that the board passed in October actually dictates, giving our staff some discretion to be able to determine what a timeline would look like. And this week, there will be a convening that our team is going to be leading with some medical experts to start that discussion, because it, in fact, is an important discussion. And of course, I'm sure you and everybody else has been reading as much as we can on the Omicron variant, of course. Again, I can say as superintendent that COVID is still a material threat. As I mentioned earlier, I am monitoring and in fact have dashboards that are related to COVID as a material threat to us continuing to serve our students. And we've got to do everything that we can to conquer this.
So with parents with children who are 5 to 11 in your district, since there are going to be conversations surrounding this, should they prepare themselves for the possibility that this vaccine mandate will extend to 5 to 11-year-olds?
That, in fact, is what the resolution calls for, Vicky. Again, just with the clarification that the timeline is what we don't have at this time. But again, our staff has already been providing the opportunity for 5 to 11-year-olds. On Wednesday, I have the opportunity of seeing lots of individuals come to the Cerna Center, our district headquarters, and I have seen every single Wednesday for the past few weeks, many of our younger students, 5 to 11-year-olds, in line waiting to be vaccinated by some of our partners here at the Cerna Center. In fact, I do want to just mention that we have 11 more clinics scheduled throughout December and January. The information is on our website. We've conducted 56 vaccine clinics to date, and we've provided almost 25,000 vaccines and almost 110,000 COVID tests have been administered by Sac City. This is how serious we are taking COVID, again, as a threat to us continuing to serve our students through in-person instruction, which we're fully committed to doing.
We got this question the last time that we had you on, and it is one that is recurring. With this requirement in effect, will the district ease or adjust some of the restrictions when it comes to larger school events or masking, such as athletics, dances, and graduations?
We've actually started to do that. I often think of it as we are taking steps to start opening up those opportunities. I was fortunate to have visited our Hiram Johnson homecoming activity, which was held outdoor. We had homecoming at most of our comprehensive high schools. Yesterday, I was able to go and see a middle school basketball game where we have also provided more flexibility during games, during some events where we have eased on some of those restrictions. But I also firmly believe that our commitment to those health and safety protocols have allowed us to stay open. I wake up every morning reading a summary of the number of positive cases among students and staff. And I'm a firm believer that that those lists would be much longer if we had not committed to those health and safety protocols.
The last time we had you on, we also discussed preventing finding fraudulent vaccine cards. That was a question from a parent. Have you found any in that time? And if so, how many?
No, I'm not aware of that number and don't suspect that that is a high number, Vicky. That is why I mentioned earlier that we have about 3,600 records that have yet to be processed that we had before, and another 3,000 that we received just yesterday. We actually have a group of very talented staff that are doing that data integrity, making sure that they're reviewing that information should that occur. But at this point, that has not happened at a rate that concerns me.
Well, that's good. Superintendent Aguilar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Jorge Aguilar is the superintendent of Sacramento City Unified School District, which is requiring proof of vaccination for students 12 and older and staff for in-person learning as of today, which was the deadline. Up next, we are going to explore Giving Tuesday. We're going to head to the Motherlode in Amador County and the outdoors along the American River Parkway. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Now that Black Friday and Cyber Monday are in the rearview mirror, today is the day where your hard-earned money can help benefit nonprofits all across the country and right here in your local community. You may have heard that CAP Radio is participating, and of course, we would be very, very appreciative of your donation to help keep shows like Insight up. But there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other worthy causes to donate to as well, and we've invited two of them from our listening area. Kathleen Harmon is the executive director of the Amador Community Foundation, and Heather Gable is the development and membership coordinator at the Effie Yaw Nature Center in Carmichael. Again, just two of the many nonprofits seeking your support today. Welcome, Heather and Kathleen, to Insight.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, Kathleen, tell us about why Giving Tuesday is essential for nonprofits in Amador County.
We're a very small community, and the ability to motivate our local residents to give to a variety of nonprofits at the end of the year kind of broadens their horizons about actually what is out there, but it also motivates them to be a little bit more generous. It's really been an amazing thing. This year we have 60 nonprofits participating, and it's kind of interesting that a small community of 32,000 people has 60 active nonprofits, but we have them. So,
and you have
it
some
essential.
Yeah, and you have some nonprofits that are just wonderful and very unique to your area.
Yes.
From, you know, the Amador Stars. I love Wood Angels. Those are volunteers that split firewood for low-income seniors and disabled veterans. Can you share some other ones that you love and really speak to the spirit of your community?
We have a group, they go by their acronym, ACDS, and what they do is they raise money during the year, and the live animal auction at the fair, what they do is they supplement the kids that are not getting high bids. So everybody has an equal share in the scholarship money that is raised for the students that work with the animals, and they infuse about $200,000 into that live animal auction. And all of that money goes into a scholarship fund for the students that raise the money. So it's that's a one that I truly love that's unique and different. We have a couple of small local theater companies, one of which actually was Bequested Properties. Volcano Theater has an outdoor amphitheater, and the Cobblestone Theater, which is the smallest indoor theater in the state of California. And so they are an all-volunteer organization. And if you know who Sarda is, Sarda actually awarded us 2 years ago the best comedy for our region. So we put on some pretty amazing theater, and they just have to raise the money to keep the properties updated. There's truly just a plethora of, we have a radio watch that they're putting up towers. We are in a high fire district, and so we constantly are battling wildfires. So we have a radio watch program that hits the remote areas where they can do like ham radios to communicate to each other in the event of a wildfire where you're not getting any internet service. We have two large animal rescue groups that will house and care for and do triage on animals that have to be removed from a fire area. Just a lot of unique stuff that happens in Amador County.
Well, just about a 45-minute hour drive from Amador County is Carmichael in Sacramento County. Heather, what does Giving Tuesday mean to Effie Yah? And I'm saying that correct, right? I've read it so many times. I've actually never said it before along the American River Parkway.
Yeah, it is Effie Yah. It was actually a school teacher's name, and we continue today in honor of the outdoor education that she started so many years ago. But Giving Tuesday is really critical for us. These end of year funds let us know what we are going to be able to offer heading into 2022. It's a really great time for our community to come together and join us in supporting this place that we want everyone to have access to.
Yeah. And when it comes to the Nature Center, how did the nearly 2 years of this pandemic impact the funds and really translate in what you're asking for today on Giving Tuesday?
Yeah, so our community did rally behind us. We had a lot of support from individuals, and we are incredibly grateful for that. A large source of our revenue comes from school programs. And with kids no longer in the classroom, we had a lot of classes need to cancel. Of course, they weren't able to come out and visit. We couldn't go to the schools because they weren't there. So we did switch over to do virtual programming, and that helped us out quite a bit. But even this year, as kids are heading back into the classroom, schools are struggling from the financial side of being able to come in and have programs, and also just understanding what their school has allowed, what their district has allowed, if we're able to come into the classrooms, if they're able to go on field trips. So that's really the area that we are trying to bridge that gap, and we want to be able to provide as much financial support to the schools as possible.
How do you describe FEA to those who haven't been and are interested in checking it out?
So the Nature Center is really a beautiful little treasure that we have here in Carmichael. It's one of the last wild spaces in our area. And if you come into the visitor center, you'll see a great museum and learn a bit about our region. You can also meet some animals that we care for. It's non-releasable wildlife like great horned owls and snakes. And these are animals that have been injured in the wild or were kept as pets. And they are incredible co-workers to be able to teach people about what we have right here in the area. And then heading outside, which of course is the best part of the Nature Center, is taking a walk and seeing the wildlife, seeing deer and coyote and turkeys, and making your way down to the American River where salmon are currently running. So that's a really exciting thing to watch, but it's a very special place.
I want to ask both of you, with social media, how has that contributed and how has that shaped the way people donate to nonprofits? Heather, let's start with you.
Yeah. So social media is really interesting. We all know it has some negative sides, but it also has a really great motivation for people. It makes giving accessible when they have Facebook fundraisers. And one of the great things about the Facebook fundraisers is that the nonprofits don't receive any fees. So your full amount is actually going to come to the nonprofit. And the other thing that's really special is that an individual can only give so much, but if they share our posts, if they start fundraisers for us, it expands our community. It invites people who have never heard of us to not only support us financially, but also come and visit, which is what we really want, is to people to get here.
Kathleen, I mean, you're talking about dozens of nonprofits throughout Amador County. How has that helped, especially during, you know, the last nearly 2 years when people couldn't physically be together in ways that they normally could have?
It has made all the difference. Last year, we raised $301,000.
Wow.
And we saw no one face-to-face. They either wrote a check or they gave online. And I do believe in social media in our community. And we're talking to you right now in our community. The newspaper and the local radio station are critical for us to get the word out, because we have a lot of elderly people that do not do social media. But as Heather said, what social media has done is it has multiplied our outreach. So every nonprofit that's participating is talking to their donor base and their social media outreach. And that's how we get to the dollars in one day that we get, is everybody doing their part to multiply the message and getting it out there. It just makes a huge difference. We started in 2015 with $30,000, and well, it was a
and now you're at
$1,000 last year,
tenfold. Yeah. And that is just, I mean, that's just wonderful to hear. Yeah. I want to thank you both so much, and I wish you the very, very best on this Giving Tuesday.
Well, I will send a total so you will know what we all generated.
Please do. That is Kathleen Harmon, the executive director of the Amador Community Foundation, as well as Heather Gabel, the development and membership coordinator at the FEA Nature Center in Carmichael. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.